You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiation Science and the Development of the Human Mind. Collected Works, Volume 228. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 29th of July, 1923. The levels of human conscious awareness, which we have been considering from several points of view in these days, vary during existence on Earth, between being fully awake, being asleep, and the dream state. In the short course of lectures I gave during the delegate conference, I did attempt to show the whole significance of dreaming. Today, let us first of all consider the question, is it part of the essential nature of human beings to live in these three states of consciousness here on earth? We need to understand that only human beings live in these three states of conscious awareness during existence on earth. Animals live in a very different alternation. They do not have the deep, dreamless sleep, which human beings have for most of the time between going to sleep and waking up. Nor do they have the full waking consciousness, which human beings have between waking up and going to sleep. The waking state of animals is really somewhat similar to human dreaming, though the conscious experiences of higher animals are more definite, richer, I'd say, than the passing dreams which human beings have. On the other hand, animals are never in the state of high degree unconsciousness in which human beings are in deep sleep. Animals, therefore, are not as distinct from their environment as are human beings. They do not have an outside world and inner world the way human beings do. To put in human words what lives as a dim awareness in higher animals is that animals really see themselves and all their inner nature as part of the outside world. When an animal sees a plant, it does not initially have the feeling that there is a plant out there and I am inwardly complete in myself. No, the animal has a powerful inner experience of the plant, a sympathy or antipathy that comes to immediate expression. The animal is, as it were, inwardly sentient of what the plant is saying. At the present time, people are so little able to observe anything that does not present itself in quite a gross way. This prevents them from simply seeing from what animals do, from their behavior, that it truly is exactly as I have said. Only human beings have this power of making clear, definite distinction between their inner world and the outside world. Why do human beings accept that there is an outside world? What makes them speak at all of an inner world and an outside world? They do so because they are always out of their physical and ether body, with their eye and astral body when asleep, leaving their physical and ether bodies to themselves, as it were, in sleep, and are with the things that are outside world. In our sleep state, we share the destiny of outside things. Tables and benches, trees and clouds are outside our physical and etheric body in our waking state, and we, therefore, refer to them as outside world. In sleep, our own astral body and our own eye are part of the outside world. And something happens whilst we belong to the outside world with our eye and astral body in sleep. To realize what is happening there, let us start with what is actually happening when we face the world in a wholly normal waking state. Physical objects are outside us, and scientific thinking has finally reached a point where only things that we can measure, weigh, and count in the physical outside world are considered to be certain. The subject matter of our physical science is determined according to weight, measure, and number. We use the methods of calculation which apply to things on Earth. We weigh things and measure them. Anything we assess according to weight, measure, and number makes up the physical world. We would not call a body physical if we were unable to demonstrate its reality in some way using the scales. However, such things as colors, sounds, even sensations of heat or cold, that is, the actual sensory perceptions, are somehow wafting across the things which have mass, measure, and number. When we want to identify any physical object, its actual physical nature is indeed whatever can be weighed and counted, and that is really the only thing physicists want to concern themselves with. When it comes to color, sound, and so on, they'll say, quote, well, something is going on outside which also has to do with weighing or counting, close quote. With regard to color phenomena, they say, quote, out there are wave motions which make an impression on human beings, and when the eye, EYE, establishes this impression, they call it color, and when the ear establishes it, they call it sound, and so on, close quote. We might actually say that modern physicists do not know what to do with all these things, sound, color, heat, and cold. They consider them to be properties of things that can be identified using scales, a measuring rod, or calculation. The colors are, in a way, attached to the physical. Sound wrests itself from the physical. Heat or cold well forth from the physical. They say that something which has weight has redness, or is red. When human beings are in the state between going to sleep and waking up, these things are different for the I, capital, and the astral body. First of all, the objects determined by measure, number, and weight simply are not there. It may seem strange, but when we are asleep, we do not have things around us that can be weighed, nor things one is able to count or measure in a direct way. When we are I and astral body in sleep, we would not be able to use a measuring rod. What we have there are, if I may put it like this, the free floating and moving sensory perceptions. However, at the present stage of evolution, human beings are unable to perceive free floating redness, freely moving sound waves, and so on. To make a diagram of this, we'd do something like this. We might say that here on Earth, we have things that are solid and can be weighed, and redness, yellowness, is in a way attached to these weighable solid objects, being what the senses perceive in those objects. When we are asleep, the yellowness is free-floating quality. The redness is free-floating quality, not attached to such conditions of gravity, but floating and moving freely. It is the same with sound. It is not that the bell sounds, but the sound is actively moving. See Figure 2. And, you know, when we walk around in our physical world and see something, we pick it up. It is only then that it is truly an object, for otherwise it might also be something that deceives the eye, EYE. There must also be weight. This is why people are so inclined to consider something which appears in the physical world, but does not have weight for them, the colors of the rainbow, for instance, to be an optical delusion. If you open a textbook on physics today, you will find that it says this is merely an optical illusion. A raindrop is considered to be truly real. And people draw in lines which really have no significance for what is there, but which are thought to go through space. They are then called, in quotes, rays. But those rays actually are not there. People then say that the eye, EYE, projects this outward for itself. This business of projection is altogether something which is applied in a most peculiar way in modern physics. So, I get the idea, quote, we see a red object. To convince ourselves that it is not an optical illusion, we pick it up, and it is heavy. This confirms that it is real. Close quote. Someone who comes to awareness in the I, capital, and astral body, outside the physical and ether bodies, will finally realize that there certainly is something of that kind in this color or sound quality which floats and moves so freely. In a color quality which thus floats freely lies the tendency to go out into far distant parts of the world. Gravity is the opposite of this. These things on earth want to go down to the center of the earth. Figure 2, arrows going down. Those arrows pointed upward want to move freely out into cosmic space. Again, readers aside, again, these are references to the diagram, and readers aside. There is also something there which is like a kind of measure. You'll discover this if there is a small reddish cloud somewhere, let us say. See figure 3. And this is hemmed with, let us say, a mighty yellow form. You then measure, not with a measuring rod, but qualitatively, using the red, which is the stronger color, to gauge the fainter yellow. And where a measuring rod would tell you that you have 5 meters, the red will here tell you, quote, "If I were to spread, I'd fit 5 times into the yellow. I have to expand, grow in size, and then I'll also be yellow." Close quote. That is the way of measuring here. It is even more difficult to get a clear idea about counting in this case, because when we count things on earth, we usually have just pears or apples lying side by side and indifferent to one another. And when we go from 1 to 2, we always have the feeling that the number 1 really is quite indifferent to the fact that there is also a number 2 beside it. This is different even in human life. There it is sometimes the case that number 1 has to depend on number 2, and that does always take us into something non-physical. With actual physical mathematics, the units are always indifferent about anything that joins them. Readers aside, footnote, for the word units, the earlier German editions had the word subdivisions. End of footnote. That is not the case here. If we have one of a particular kind somewhere here, it calls for some, let us say, 3 or 5 more, depending on how it is. Bracket, see figure 2, dots and small circles in red, close bracket. There is always an inner connection with the others, and the number is something real. When there begins to be conscious awareness about how it is when one is out there with one's eye and astral body, one will also come to establish something like measure, number and weight, but of the opposite kind. One's seeing and hearing out there is no longer a mere wishy-washiness of red and yellow and sounds, but we begin even there to be sentient of things having an order. We begin to perceive the spirits who bring themselves to realization in these free-floating sensory perceptions. We then enter into the positive spiritual world, into the life and activities of the spirits. Here on earth we enter into the life and activities of earthly things by weighing, measuring, and counting them. Learning the opposite to being heavy in a qualitative way, that is, seeking to expand easily, lightly into cosmic space, measuring color with color, and so on, we begin to grasp the nature of the spirits. Such spirits are also present throughout everything out there in the natural worlds. In the waking state of mind, we human beings see only the outer aspects of minerals, plants, and animals. But in sleep, we are with the spiritual element, which lives in all these entities in the natural worlds. When we return to ourselves as we wake up, the I and astral body do in a way retain the inclination toward, the affinity with, the objects outside, making us accept the reality of an outside world. If we had an organization that was not made for sleep, we would not accept the fact of an outside world. It is not a question of someone suffering from insomnia, of course, for I am not saying, quote, when people do not sleep, but if we had an organization that was not made for sleep, close quote. It is a matter of being prepared for something. This is also why people get sick when suffering from insomnia, for that is not in accord with their nature. But the way things are is that exactly because people dwell with their outside world in sleep, with the world which on waking they call their outside world, they also arrive at an outside world, a view of the outside world. This relationship which people have to sleep provides the earthly concept of truth. In how far? Well, we call it truth when we are able to recreate the image of something outside within us. When we have a real living experience of something from outside within us. For this, we need the institution of sleep. We would have no concept of truth if we did not have the institution of sleep. We are therefore able to say that we owe the truth to the sleep state. To give ourselves up to the truth of things, we must also spend some of our time with them. The objects only tell us something about themselves because in our souls we are with them in sleep. It is different for the dream state. As I told you in the short course of lectures during the delegate conference, the dream is related to memory, to the inner life, to the quality that lives above all in memory. When the dream is a free-floating world of sound and color, we are still halfway out of our body. When we enter in completely, the powers that we unfold in a living, active way in our dream turn into powers of memory. We are then no longer distinct from the outside world. Our inner life comes together with the outside world, and we live so powerfully in the outside world with our sympathies and antipathies that we are not sentient of those things as sympathetic or antipathetic, but that the sympathies and antipathies themselves assume image nature. If it were not possible for us to dream, with this dream power continuing on in our inner life, we would not have beauty. The fact that we actually have potential for beauty is due to our ability to dream. In everyday life, we have to say that we owe it to dream power that we have a memory. When it comes to art in human life, we owe beauty to the power of dream. The dream state is thus connected with beauty. For the way in which we are sentient of something, being beautiful, and create something that is beautiful, is very close to the active, mobile power of dreaming. When we experience beauty or create something beautiful, though we need our physical body to do so, we are behaving in a way which is similar to the way in which we behave when out of our physical body or half-connected with our physical body, when we dream. It is just a short step, really, a tiny shift from dreaming to living in beauty. And it is just that people are so gross in the materialistic age we live in that they do not notice this tiny shift, and they have so little awareness of the whole significance of beauty. One must of necessity give oneself up to it in one's dreams in order to experience this free, floating, and active life. If you give yourself to freedom, to inner arbitrariness, that is, if you live after the shift, you will no longer be sentient of it, being the same as dreaming, for it is the same only when one uses the powers of the physical body. People today will go on for a long time thinking about what one meant by saying chaos in earlier times. The term is defined in many different ways. But the only true way of characterizing the term chaos is to say when human beings enter into a state of conscious awareness where the experience of weight, an earthly measure, has just come to an end, and things begin to be only half that weight, yet do not yet want to go out into the universe, but remain in the horizontal, in balance, when solid boundaries begin to wave, so that the indefinite aspect of the world is seen still with the physical body, but already with the mental constitution of dreaming, that is when we see chaos. And the dream is but chaos, floating toward the human being like a shadow. In ancient Greece, people were still sentient of the fact that we cannot really make the physical world beautiful. The physical world is necessarily natural. It is as it is. We can only create beauty from chaos. Beauty arises when we transform chaos into cosmos. Chaos and cosmos are therefore alternatives. We cannot create the cosmos, the real meaning is, quote, beautiful world, close quote, from earthly things, but only from chaos, by giving form and order to chaos. And anything we do with earthly objects is mere imitation in material form of chaos that has been given order. That is the case with everything in the sphere of art. In Greece, the idea of this relationship between chaos and cosmos was still very much alive under the remaining influence of the culture of the mysteries. However, when we go about in all these worlds, in the world where the human being is unconscious when in a state of sleep, and half-conscious when in a dream state, if we go anywhere in those worlds, we will not find the good. The spirits in these worlds have, with great wisdom, been predetermined from the very beginning of their lives. We find active wisdom prevailing in them, and we find beauty in them. But it is pointless to speak of goodness if it is a question of getting to know these spirits when we come to them as earthlings. We can only say goodness when there is a difference between inner and outside world, so that the good can follow the spiritual world or not follow it. The sleep state is assigned to the truth, the dream state to beauty, and the waking state to goodness, to the good. This does not go against what I have been saying these days, which is that when we leave the earthly sphere and go out into the cosmos, we are also made to let go of earthly concepts and speak of a moral world order. For the moral world order is predetermined in the spiritual sphere, of necessity, just as causality is here on earth, except that there it is a spiritual predetermination, being well-defined in itself. No contradiction, therefore. But when it comes to human nature, we have to understand that if we want to have the idea of truth, we have to turn to the sleep state. If we want to have the idea of beauty, we must turn to the dream state. And if we want to have the idea of goodness, we must turn to the waking state. In the waking state, human beings are therefore not determined according to truth, but according to goodness in their physical and etheric organism. So this is where we must really come to the idea of goodness in that case. A footnote. In earlier editions, the word chaos had been added to the table. Oh, there's a table up there. A careful look at the drawing has shown, however, that the word had been written on the board earlier. That is when Rudolf Steiner used it in the preceding part of his lecture. End of footnote. And the table they're talking about, I did not read it. I will read it now. Is sleep state truth, dream state beauty, waking state goodness. End of footnote. Now I would ask you, what are the aims in modern science when people want to explain the human being? Seeking to explain the human being in the waking state, one does not move up from truth to beauty and then goodness. The aim is to explain everything according to an external causal necessity. And this is only in accord with the idea of truth. There we do not arrive at the life and activity in the human being, but only at something which at best is only the sleeping human being. So if you read books on anthropology today and do so with an eye that is awake, EYE, awake to the soul qualities and powers of the world, the impression you gain is as follows. You say to yourself, quote, well, it is very nice that we are told about the human being in modern science, but what is this human being of which we are told in science really like? He's lying in bed all the time, for he is unable to walk. He cannot move, for movement is absolutely not explained, for instance. So he lies in bed all the time. Close quote. The human being presented in science can only be explained as someone lying in bed. Nothing else is possible. Only the sleeping human being is explained in science. One would have to use mechanical means to set him in motion. This also means that science is a mechanism. Machinery has to be put into this sleeping human being to get this floppy sack moving and out of bed and put him to bed again at night. Science thus tells us nothing at all about the human being who walks about, is alive and active, is awake. For the principle that sets him in motion lies in the idea of goodness and not the idea of truth that we initially gain from external objects. This is something to which people do not give much thought. When a present-day physiologist or anatomist gives one a description of the human being, one really feels like saying, quote, wake up, you're asleep, you really are asleep, close quote. Under the influence of this philosophy of life, people get used to being in a state of sleep. I have had to say again and again that people are really sleeping through all kinds of things because they are obsessed with science. With popular papers spreading everything far and wide, even people with little education are obsessed with science today. Never before have so many people been obsessed. They are obsessed with science. It is really strange how one has to speak when one has to describe the real situation today. One has to use a very different language than the language that is generally used today. That is also how it is when someone is introduced a little into the world around him by the materialists. When materialism was at its height, people wrote such books as the one, for instance, which in one particular chapter said, quote, man as such is really nothing. He is the product of the oxygen in the air. He is the product of the low or high temperature in which he finds himself. He is really, close quote, thus the pathetic ending of this materialistic description, continue quote, the outcome of every breath of air, close quote. If one goes into this and imagines someone who really is what the materialistic scientist is saying there, then it is someone who is utterly neurasthenic. The materialists have never described any other kind of human being. They failed to realize that they were actually describing human beings in their sleep. And when they acted in an untypical way and wanted to move on, they never described anything but people who were to a high degree neurasthenic, and who would have had to die the very next day from all this neurasthenia, being quite unable to live. The science of this age has never provided real insight into the living human being. This is where the great tasks lie, which have to guide humanity out of present-day conditions into conditions which are the only ones under which world history can live on. What is needed is that we penetrate into spirituality. The opposite pole must be found to what has been achieved so far. What has really been achieved, especially in the course of the 19th century, which has been so glorious from the materialistic point of view. In a wonderful way, we may truly and honestly say so, it has proved possible to determine the outside world according to measure, number, and weight as earthly world. Tremendous, magnificent achievements have been made in this respect in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But the sensory perceptions, colors, and sounds are just fluttering around intermittently. Physicists no longer speak of colors and sounds. They speak of air, waves, and ether waves, which are neither color nor sound. Air waves are not sounds. At most, they are the medium on which sounds travel. And there is no understanding of sensory qualities. This is something we'll have to come back to again. Essentially, people only see things that can be weighed, measured, or calculated. The rest escapes them. When the theory of relativity, then, also creates the grand disorder of which I spoke yesterday, for anything that can be measured, weighed, and counted, everything breaks up and falls apart. There are limits, however, boundaries, where the theory of relativity fails. Not in its concepts. You cannot escape the theory of relativity if you use earthly concepts. I spoke of this on another occasion. But if you use reality, you will always escape from the concepts of relativity. For anything that can be measured, counted, and weighed does, because of measure, number, and weight, enter into quite specific relationships in the outside reality perceived through the senses. A physicist, or a number of physicists in Stuttgart, once objected to the way in which anthroposophists spoke of the theory of relativity. During a discussion, this physicist did the simple experiment to show that it is really quite irrelevant if I have the matchbox here and strike the match against it, it will burn. Or if I keep the match still and move the matchbox against it, it will also burn. It is relative. Yes, of course, here it will still be relative, and with regard to anything relating to a Newtonian space or a Euclidean space, all of it will be relative. But as soon as we come to the reality which presents as heaviness, as weight, it is no longer as easy as Einstein imagined it, for then relations are real. One really has to be paradoxical in this case. Relativity can be shown to be valid where one confuses the reality as a whole with mathematics and geometry and mechanics. But this will no longer work when one comes to genuine reality. For surely it is not just relative whether I eat the roast veal or the roast veal eats me. You can do this one way round or the other with a matchbox, but you have to eat the roast veal. You cannot let the roast veal eat you. So there are situations where these concepts of relativity have their limits. The point is that when one says this in the world at large, people will say, quote, absolutely lacks all insight into this serious theory, close quote. But the logic of it is the way I said. It is just like that. I cannot change it. It is a matter, therefore, of seeing how, if we are taking account of the weight, that is, of the quality which really makes it a physical body, we cannot really bring in colors, sounds, and so on anywhere in a real way, I'd say. And this tendency means that we have lost something which is extraordinarily important. We have lost the artistic element. This goes away as we grow more and more physical. No one will find even a trace of art in the physics books of today. Nothing is left of art. All of it is to go out. It is quite horrible to study a book on physics today, if one still has the least sense of beauty. With everything which makes up beauty, using color and sound, with all of that being outlawed, only given recognition when it is attached to things that have weight, humanity is losing art. Art has been lost today, and the more people go into physics, the more inartistic do they grow. Just consider, we have a magnificent science of physics, and there is no need for the opposition to tell us so. As anthroposophists, we do say that we have a magnificent science of physics. But physics lives by repudiating the artistic element. In every single aspect, it lives by repudiating the artistic element, for in physics, one has come to treat the world in a way where the artist does not take the least account of the physicist. I do not believe, for instance, that musicians consider it worthwhile today to study the physical theories on acoustics. They find it boring and not of any concern to them. Nor will a painter be inclined to study the dreadful theory of colors which one finds in physics. If he does at all want to know about colors, he will, as a rule, turn to Goethe's theory of colors. The physicists say that Goethe's theory is wrong, however, but they'll shrug their shoulders and say, quote, ah, well, it does not really matter if painters adopt the right or the wrong theory of color, close quote. The point is that art must perish if today's physical view of the world reigns. So we have to ask ourselves, why did art exist in earlier times? If we go back to very early times, to times when human beings still had an original clairvoyance, people were not so much aware of the measure, number, and weight of things on earth. They did not really care much for measure, number, and weight. They were more inclined to give themselves up to the colors and sounds of things on earth. Just remember that weight has only been considered since Lavoisier in chemistry for a little more than 100 years. Weight was first applied in a philosophy of life at the end of the 18th century. Those early human beings simply were not aware that everything has to be determined according to earthly measure, number, and weight. They were given up in heart and mind to the tapestry of colors, the waves and movements of sound in the world. Not the airwaves, but the waves and movements of sound. This is what they gave themselves up to. They lived in these things, also when living in the physical world. What potential lay in this way of living in sensory perception, free from all weight? It made it possible, for instance, to see a person one was approaching, not the way people are seen today, but one would look at the person as something which had been brought about by the whole universe. The human being was more a coming together of the cosmos. He would be more of a microcosm than anything that is within his skin on the small bit of ground on which he would be standing. They were more seeing a reflection of the world in a human being. Colors would flow in from all sides to give the human being his colors. The harmony of the world was there, sounding through the human being, giving him his form. Today it is almost impossible to understand what the teachers in the ancient mysteries told their disciples. For when someone wants to explain the human heart today, he takes an embryo and sees how the blood vessels bud, and at first there is a tube, with the heart gradually taking shape. That is not how the teachers in the ancient mysteries spoke to their pupils. They would have considered it no more important than what goes on when you knit a sock, for ultimately the process seems much the same. But they put emphasis on something which they considered tremendously important. They would say, quote, the human heart is the outcome of the gold which lives everywhere in the light, gold which comes streaming in from the universe and actually creates the human heart, close quote. The way they saw it was this. Light moves through the universe, and the light bears the gold, see figure 4. Gold is everywhere in the light. It is alive and active in the light. And during life on earth, the human heart, as you know, it changes every 7 years, is not made up of the cucumbers and lettuce and roast veal which people have been eating, but, and the ancient teachers knew it, of the gold in the light. The cucumbers and the lettuce merely provide an impulse, so that the gold which lives in the light makes up the heart out of the whole universe. Yes, people put things in a different way, and we must become aware of this difference, for we have to learn to speak the way they did again, except that it will be at a different level of conscious awareness. In the past, painters painted out of the universe, for things did not have weight then. This is gone. Last traces can still be seen with Cimabue, for instance, and above all in the Russian icons. The icon is still painted out of the outer world, out of the macrocosm. It is a detail from the macrocosm. Then, however, a dead end was reached. It was not possible to go any further, because humanity simply no longer had the eye for it, EYE. To be inwardly involved in painting the icon, and not just do so in the traditional way, one would have needed to know how to treat the gold. The treatment given to the gold in the painting was one of the greatest secrets in the art of painting. To let the human form arise against the background of gold, that was the old way of painting. There is a vast abyss between Cimabue and Giotto. Giotto was already beginning to do something which Raphael then took to a particular height. Cimabue still had it from tradition. Readers aside, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this word right. Cimabue is spelled C-I-M-A-B-U-E, and I apologize if I'm getting that incorrect. End of readers aside. Giotto was halfway turning into a naturalist. He realized that the tradition did no longer come alive in the soul. So one must now take the physical human being, for one no longer had the universe. It was no longer possible to let the painting arise from the gold. One had to base oneself on the flesh. Finally, this went so far that painting widely came to be what it was in the 19th century. The icons were weightless, quote, shown in, close quote, from the world. They had no weight. One cannot paint them any more today, but when they were painted in their original form, they would have had no weight at all. Giotto first began to paint things so that they had weight. As time went on, it was so that everything was painted had weight also in the painting, and it would then be colored from outside. Colors then related to the things that were in the paintings so as to be in accord with the physicist's idea that the color arises there on the surface due to some particular wave movement. In the end, art was also reckoning with the weight. Giotto did, however, begin in an aesthetic, artistic way, and Raphael took it to its greatest height. We may say, therefore, that the universe was lost to humanity at that point, and the weighty human being came to be the only thing one was able to see. The feelings of earlier times were still there, and so the flesh had as little weight as possible, but it did grow heavy. Then the Madonna appeared as the counterpart to the icon. The icon, which was weightless, the Madonna, who had weight, however beautiful she may be. The beauty survived. But icons can now no longer be painted at all, for human beings have no living experience of them. It is not true when people believe themselves to have living experience of icons today. Which is also why icon culture was touched by a degree of sentimental untruthfulness. That is a dead end in art. It became schematic and traditional. Raphael's art, which really was based on what Giotto had made of Cimabue, this could only continue to be art for as long as the ancient glory of beauty still rested on it. In a way, it was the sunny paintings of the Renaissance, who were still somewhat sentient of the gold that lived in the light, and at least gave their paintings the luster, letting the gold living in the light shine on them from outside. It came to an end, however. Naturalism arose, and in art, humanity finds itself sitting between two chairs today, on the ground between icon and Madonna, and will have to find a way of discovering pure, actively moving color and tone, with weight, measurability, and weighable numerability the opposite. We must learn to paint out of color. However tentative and poor our attempts may be, it is our challenge to paint out of color, to gain living experience of the color as such, free from all weight. We must be able to proceed in full awareness, full artistic awareness, with these things. When you look at what we were aiming at in the simple attempts on our programs, you will realize it may only be a beginning, but at least a start has been made in freeing colors from weight, gaining living experience of color as something which is self-sustaining, and letting the colors speak to us. If this can be achieved, an art will be created in contrast to the inartistic, physical view of the world, which makes all art evaporate. By taking the free element of color, of sound, and having an art again which is free from gravity. Yes, we are sitting between the two chairs of Icon and Madonna, but we must get up. The science of physics will not help us in this. As I told you, if one applies only physical science to the human being, one will always have to remain lying in bed. But now we must get up. And for this we truly need science of the spirit. This has the element of life which takes us from weight, gravity, to color, which is weightless, from being bound up even in musical naturalism to an art of music that is free, and so forth. We can see everywhere how we need to gather ourselves up, the need for humanity to wake up. We should take up this impulse to come awake, to look out and see what is and is not, and where the challenges are everywhere, to move ahead. This is what I really intended before this summer break occasioned by the visit to England. I had to want to do both at the delicate conference, and now in these days to conclude with the very thoughts which I presented to you. These things do touch a nerve in our time, and it is necessary that we let the other element shine into our movement, which is what I have tried to suggest. I have told you how the philosopher of the present time has come to admit to himself, quote, "Where does this intellectualism take us? To build a giant machine at the center of the earth so that it will make the earth explode out into all the spaces in the universe?" Close quote. He admitted to himself that that is the situation. The others are not admitting it to themselves. I have tried, therefore, to show all kinds of occasions. For instance, when I showed you yesterday how concepts that still existed 30 or 40 years ago are today dissolved away by the theory of relativity, simply melting away like snow in the sun. To show that we are indeed challenged everywhere to find our way to anthroposophy. The philosopher Edward von Hartmann says, quote, "If the world is the way we have to imagine it to be," close quote, meaning as he has to imagine it in the 19th century sense, continue quote, "we cannot bear to continue in it, and so we must really make it explode out into cosmic space, and it is merely a matter of reaching the point one day when we can do so. We must be longing for the time when we can make the world explode out into the whole wide universe." Close quote. Before that, the relativists will see to it that human beings no longer have any concepts. Space, time, motion dissolve. And this can indeed lead to such despair that under certain circumstances one will consider that the greatest satisfaction will lie in thus making our world explode into the whole universe. It is necessary for us to understand clearly the particular impulses that pertain to our age. Because of this, the last lectures had to be given exactly the form which was given to them, letting external culture shine into our ranks. They were also a challenge for you to open your eyes, and I tried to make these lectures such that one could see what it means when we say that the Anthroposophical Society must make every effort to avoid all sectarianism, to rise above sectarianism. It would be good, my friends, if you were to use the time when I have to be away now for a few weeks to reflect on how one will get out of this sectarianism. Otherwise, the situation simply will be that the Anthroposophical Society gets caught up more and more in sectarianism. And there are clear signs not of casting sectarianism aside, but of sailing full tilt into a sectarian approach. We must exercise our minds to see how sectarianism can be avoided. I wanted to refer to this briefly again, because it is really most important to refer to it. I wanted to make you aware of how particularly in these last lectures I've tried to speak in such a way that people will everywhere look out into the world, as it were, not cocooning ourselves in a sect, but living in the world with open eyes, a practical approach, being part of the world, that is absolutely conformable with entering most deeply into the spiritual sphere. I have therefore told you that today people must even know that it is possible for an Indian, Ramanathan, to look at European civilization and tell the Europeans, quote, ask for teachers about Jesus to come from India, for you really do not understand Jesus Christ at all. We only came to understand the matter when we started to read the New Testament, close quote. If we want to be sectarian, as there was evidence for this at the delegate conference, we shall not manage the great task which anthroposophy faces at the present time. And it must be managed, for it concerns the whole of humanity. I hope this has touched your hearts, as I now say goodbye for a few weeks. We will announce future events in the usual way. During the next few weeks, there will be lectures and Eurythmy performances in various places in England. So let us now prepare for a summer break, in such a way that we let our hearts be very much alive and develop proper sentience of this. How should we feel so that the evolution of humanity may proceed in the right and proper way? The end of Lecture 3, translated by Anna Moyse, and the end of Part 1 of the book Initiation Science by Rudolf Steiner.